Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you can put it on your iPod or your computer or on a disc, whenever you really want to listen to it, basically. Today we have an excellent show as we begin to do some shows on government investigations and look at how does e-discovery behave the same when agencies are asking for ESI instead of civil litigants. When you heard me last week discuss how I missed 35% of my constitutional law classes and still eked out a B in my third year, I frankly believe law review is a great thing for third year students, but I digress. The truth of the matter is, outside of some very interesting antitrust work I did as an attorney, I haven't encountered much administrative work. But as I've begun talking to a number of attorneys who spend a lot of time with government investigations, I've become more and more fascinated with how regulatory work interplays with the discovery, especially since government investigations, unlike civil litigation, don't seem to have slowed down over the past year. Some initial observations are much of how e-discovery process develops revolves around power. And in civil litigation, all of us e-discovery attorneys are very familiar with what happens when one side has ESI and the other side doesn't. E-discovery in that world is much different than when compared with a situation where both sides have ESI. In a government investigation, the government might have very little ESI, and they're asking for your ESI. So what happens next? How does that power impact the outcome? These are the types of things we're going to look at. And as a framework for this show, I was going to talk through some of the stages of an e-discovery project and weave in some of the current hot topics like cooperation and meet and confers to see how this works when the government's an adversary. And we have an outstanding panel to help us talk about this, and I'm really looking forward to doing this show. And first of all, the someone who helped give me the idea for the show is Marion Smolin, who serves as Associate General Counsel in the Litigation Department for Fannie Mae in Washington, D.C. In this role, she manages complex commercial litigations and government investigations and directs the legal support of the company's anti-fraud activities, including investigation of mortgage fraud. Miriam also serves as e-discovery counsel for the company managing litigation holds, document productions, and vendor relationships. Previously, she served in Fannie Mae's Office of Corporate Compliance, where she created and implemented compliance plans to mitigate legal and regulatory risk for business operations. Miriam's a frequent presenter of mortgage fraud and electronic discovery topics. From 1989 through 2003, she was an assistant U.S. attorney with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia and served a detail with the Department of Justice Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section. She investigated and tried dozens of violent crime, narcotics, and financial fraud cases, including multi-million dollar embezzlements, health fraud, care, and computer crime. She specialized in health care fraud and intellectual property and computer crime. Miriam received numerous Justice Department Special Achievement Awards and was awarded the Department of Health and Human Services Integrity Award for prosecution of Medicaid fraud. Justin Murphy is our next panelist. He's counsel at Crowell & Mooring's Washington, D.C. office, where he practices in the White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group and e-discovery and information management group. Justin's practice focuses on SEC enforcement, white-collar criminal matters, e-discovery matters relating to internal and government investigations, and related civil litigation. He's represented and counseled corporate and individual clients in all phases of securities, white-collar criminal and civil investigations and proceedings involving the SEC, FINRA, Department of Justice, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, CFTC, and other agencies. So, Justin, we're thrilled to have you on the program. And Chris Denig is of counsel in the Covington & Burling's Washington, D.C. office and is a member of their litigation, white-collar defense investigations, and SEC enforcement, International E-Discovery Informs Corrupt Practices Act groups. His practice focuses on representing clients in complex federal civil litigations, including class actions, internal corporate investigations, government investigations, congressional investigations, and compliance matters. I'm thrilled to have all of you guys on the show. And First of all, I'd like to start off by asking how each of you got interested in electronic discovery. Miriam, why don't we start with you?
Well, good morning, Carl. Thanks for having us on the show today. I'd have to say that my involvement in e-discovery was more of a matter of necessity than perhaps personal choice. Through my work as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, we were dealing with cases with masses of documents and had just begun to stick our toe into the issue of using vendors and using better and more sophisticated systems for managing that documents. When I switched over into corporate practice, it really became a matter of necessity as our company and every company deals with litigations and investigations that collect and need to manage millions of pages of documents in ESI formats. And so it was perhaps trial by fire, but it has proven to be quite the education.
Okay. And Justin, yourself?
In my work in representing companies and individuals in government investigations and in other criminal matters, I've had the opportunity to be involved in and really sink my teeth into a lot of challenging and interesting e-discovery related issues, like Miriam, often by necessity, and really at the outset of what's now a burgeoning field. So although the primary focus on e-discovery, I think, up till now has really been focused on civil matters, we're now really beginning to see e-discovery issues come into the criminal side. And I've enjoyed being involved in such a rapidly expanding field.
And Chris?
Yeah, it's an increasingly important part of any large government investigation practice and has significant substantive and cost implications for clients. So I just think it's an area where if you want to be an effective advocate for your client, you really have to be deeply involved and have knowledge of these important e-discovery issues.
Okay, well, let's dive into the topic. And I think the best way to talk about this is to use the civil side as a framework to compare to government investigation. So let's talk about the trigger point for a case. Miriam, what is the basis usually for government investigation for the trigger point?
Well, using the civil side is a good comparison because it is, again, when you as the attorney or in this case in-house counsel or outside counsel advising you have knowledge, have a basis for believing that you're going to be involved in some kind of either litigation or investigation that's going to require documents. So it's more than speculation, which is really the same standard, but it doesn't always have to be when you receive the subpoena. It often you often need to be cognizant of the fact that a litigation hold needs to be going out before then. I think a special issue around government investigations is often the fact that you don't know that these are coming, and therefore when the investigation shows up and you are required to then at that point preserve documents, it's a bit of a scramble because you want to respond as quickly as possible. I'd add one more point from an internal perspective. You know, we look at when we have some type of internal investigation, you know, there's always a litigation hold that goes on around that for the purposes of the internal investigation, but we're also looking at those to determine if they're maybe any possible interest in it externally and reviewing the hold against that perspective.
Okay. Justin, now that a case is apparent, what are the preservation obligations and how important is preservation in a government investigation? And also, are there any unique challenges with preservation in a government investigation?
Well, I think as Miriam said, that the standard is the same as it is in the civil arena. I think what's interesting and unique about the government investigations or on the criminal side is that the consequences of failing to preserve potentially relevant ESI can be broader and far more severe. You have both direct and then more subtle and collateral consequences as well. The direct consequences stem from two criminal statutes developed or arising out of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, 18 U.S.C. 1519 and 18 U.S.C. 1512C, which specifically target ESI and can expose your client to additional investigation or charges of obstruction of justice. Keep in mind that obstruction of justice is often easier to prove than the underlying crime, which may involve complicated issues that are ill-suited to a jury trial. And as Miriam noted, you don't need pending or imminent investigation. for this, for these two statutes to be effect, you just need that the defendants took steps to obstruct. The more subtle or collateral consequences from failing to preserve ESI, it may color the views of the prosecutors at the outset of a case, which may affect judgments about cooperation or culpability, which in turn affects charging decisions and plea negotiations. It may also increase one sentencing guidelines calculation. There's one unique aspect, which I like to call the internal investigation conundrum, which I think is worth mentioning. This is a situation where the government's not in the picture yet, but you have a whistleblower and you represent a company, and you need to conduct an investigation to look into the allegations. You can't take the usual steps, such as issuing a broad hold order, as you need to keep the investigation confidential. So the question is really how you preserve the evidence that may be necessary to a government investigation which may come down the road. You can take surreptitious steps. You can capture ESI from servers. You may even choose to go into offices at night and collect and hope that if a government investigation does surface down the road, you can convince the government that you've struck the right balance between preserving evidence and compromising the integrity of the internal investigation. What is very important is that you maintain a clear record of the decision-making steps along that way.
Okay. And this is Chris. I just wanted to add one thing to what Justin was saying. I tell clients it's just a critical backstop, the preservation, in order to keep things from going off the rails with the government. Because if you're careful about preservation and preserving for the right custodians, the right kind of documents, then, you know, down the road you can always go back to that information, look at it again, run other searches, do other things that the government might ask you to do. If you don't preserve effectively and the government asks you to do something and that material is gone or you didn't think about that particular custodian, that could be a difficult conversation to have.
Let me add one more unique challenge with government investigations, and this is really from a general in-house perspective, and that is simply the breadth. Typically, holds related to government investigations are broader than you might find in your, I don't know if there is such a thing as a typical, but your typical commercial litigation. That may stem from the fact that the government is trying to capture as much as possible. It may simply stem from the fact that they don't have all the facts yet about the scheme, and they are being deliberately overbroad. And the impact, of course, in-house is the cost, the space, the time in executing those holds. However, what is even worse sometimes is when another agency, either the same agency or another agency, comes into an investigation and they actually want to expand the hold. That is probably the most difficult thing that corporations undertake because of all the processes put around a hold. If you tell people, well, hold back to this point in time, and then you are then told, oh, no, we want you to go back an additional year or two, you know, it's a very scary proposition that perhaps you have deleted, destroyed, allowed your processes, your normal retention processes to go ahead for that earlier time period, and now you're finding out perhaps 6 months later that the government would like you to extend it.
Boy, it sounds like communication is really critical in this phase when you're dealing with the government. So, Chris, now let's enter what I think we agree is the most important phase of this of a government investigation or multiple government investigations. Is how do you interact with a government entity? While there's no formal meet and confer, you know, why don't you tell me a little bit about this process and what the objectives are?
Yeah, this is a critical part of the process because these initial contacts with the government can really set the tone for the entire case. And you want to be showing from the outset that your client is taking the matter seriously, is going to be responsive, straightforward, transparent with the government. You know, you're not going to roll over, but you're going to be straightforward and transparent with them. So what I've found that's effective is to, once a subpoena, say, lands on my desk from a client, to do some pretty quick due diligence with the client on both substantive issues and kind of the e-discovery document-related matters, and then put in a quick initial call to the government to just kind of say, we've received your subpoena or request for information. We're on the case. we're learning more from our client. We'll be in touch with you very soon to have a more substantive discussion. So sort of an initial just reach out to the government can be critical. Then on a second, more substantive call that might happen within a couple of days, you want to do a deeper dive with your client on these various e-discovery and document-related challenges that you might be facing. And when I have that second call with the government, I like to have proposals in mind. Don't let the government dictate where they want to go, because you might not like that so much. So try to steer them, if you can, in certain directions based on what you already know. So you want to have your ducks in a row as much as you can to make a forceful case with the government for why your proposed approach is reasonable. And this is when you would want to start to discuss issues like, what does the government really want? As Miriam was saying, often these subpoenas can be incredibly broad, but you could start having discussions about what's really at the heart of the case, what does the government really want to get at, and you should have some ideas in mind of what are the key documents, who are the key custodians, and start to talk about categories of documents and key custodians. Start to talk about prioritizing documents or custodians for the government. Again, don't let them dictate. Try to think about it with your client and have some ideas. Begin to discuss what are realistic timeframes for making productions. Things like rolling productions on a prioritized basis. And again, to have these effective discussions with the government, you've got to be talking with your client both in a substantive way, but also talking with their IT people, making decisions about whether you might need an external vendor, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later on in this discussion. But these are all some of the critical initial due diligence kinds of questions and discussions you want to have with your client so that you can have an effective initial set of discussions with the government to really set the tone for the case going forward. And Justin, I'm sure you'll have some things to add to that.
Sure, I agree with everything that Chris noted. It's what we're talking about here is an analog almost to a Rule 26F conference. There is no criminal rule analog, but we're essentially talking about having those same conversations. A few other things to note. Certainly, coming to an agreement in a criminal case can sometimes be more challenging because the symmetry of risks and interests between the two parties that you'll find in civil litigation generally does not exist. The government is not as worried about the boomerang effect of imposing unfair burdens on defense counsel. Chris talked about some of the items that it's important to try and discuss and negotiate and reach agreement on. I heartily agree. And this can relate back to how well you've preserved your data. If you are able to give the government confidence that you have preserved and done a good job of preserving the data, the more comfortable the government is with the preservation, the more willing they will be to discuss deferring portions of your production or limiting the number of custodians or limiting by date. The less comfortable the government is with your preservation efforts, the government may want more data and raw data at that. Another perhaps less obvious benefit to having these discussions is the opportunity to influence how the government's going to view the client and perhaps even get some insight into who the government thinks is key and what the government really is focused on, as Chris mentioned. One last thing I'll add is that your status in the investigation may impact what you can accomplish. If you are an innocent third party, you certainly may have more opportunity and room for negotiation. If you are a target or the subject, the government may really stand fast and you may not have as much room in terms of what you're able to preserve and what you're able to produce and any limitations on that.
So it sounds like, this is really compressed in a small period of time that you're just trying to establish credibility right up front and get to a reasonable scope. But it sounds like it's more than just a meeting. It's got to be an ongoing dialogue with continued credibility, being shown, right? I mean, is that That's typical?
That's absolutely right. And I try to make those points with the government in these initial meetings that again, I want to be open and transparent with them. I'm going to be talking with them about the approaches that seem reasonable to us in terms of these e-discovery issues. If they have concerns, I want them to raise them with me. You know, open door policy shouldn't be a gotcha or anything like that. My client is trying to do this in the most effective way possible. And I'm anticipating an open dialogue with the government going forward for as long as this investigation lasts. And as everyone on the call knows, sometimes these investigations can literally go on for, you know, a year or more. So there's a lot of back and forth with the government, and you want to establish that kind of straightforward trust relationship with the government right from the outset.
And you know, there's a lot of information out there about meet and confers, about, you know, coming up with a collection method, search terms, methodology, number of priority custodians, how you're going to produce it. I guess that's all part of your dialogue. But one of the things I'm less clear about right now is, what's your time frame for having to start to produce ESI to an agency? You know, what is there sort of a, I guess every case is different, but what's your general guidance on a short period versus maybe a long period of time before you start producing?
Discuss perhaps some practical aspects in response to your question, and then to add to the really good overview that we just heard from Justin and Chris, and it does incorporate the timing, because as was just discussed, this is an open door discussion with the government, and it is a continual iterative process to refine what they're looking for through their particular requests and what you are producing back to them. And so what will typically happen is that once the recipient of a subpoena or a document request gets some handle around what the sources of data are, there should be some type of meeting of what the potential search terms or other technology that you're going to use to dive into the data and to do some testing of the data around that. When we talk about timeframes, I think everybody will agree that typically, government investigators want as much material as they can get as quickly as possible. And will also often put out their very short time frames, which are really just not possible given the volume of data that needs to be collected, reviewed, and then reviewed for privilege before it's produced. And so one technique that many companies use, that many recipients of subpoena use, is to do a rolling production and to start with some type of testing of the types of search, let's say we're using search terms that the government is thinking, to see if that's hitting the type of data that they want and the scope of the data that they want. And once you've begun to refine it, then you can start your collection and review. And it's a continuous iterative discussion building on those various search terms. You are definitely trying to capture as much of the breadth as you can in the beginning, because it does become very difficult if later on in the investigation you are asked to go back and search in the same volume of data for different terms. You'd like this to continue to go on because you've already done review and have set certain review standards for your data. So as much as possible to have that type of discussion is extremely important. And I would just add one other thing, and that is that it is often very useful to provide to the government, how you're staffing this matter, how many people, you know, if you're usually using outside counsel, are on the matter, are reviewing, are working, what the time frame, how long does it take to review a certain volume of data, because then by doing that, hopefully what you're doing is you're helping the government set their own expectations about when they can expect to see things, and also so that they know if all of a sudden a different issue percolates to the top of their list as their highest priority, the communication from the producer of the documents that, okay, we hear you, but this means we are reallocating resources to this other topic that is your priority, so you understand that the production in these other areas that we were working on is going to be delayed.
Well, this is all great stuff. Now, one thing that comes to my mind when you know, because these cases in the civil side, a lot of how well the cases go depends on how sophisticated both sides of the both parties are. So, Justin, can sophistication be an issue with a government agency?
Absolutely, it can. And certainly there's varying levels of sophistication within among government attorneys, just as there's varying levels of sophistication relating to electronic matters in-house and in private practice. It's certainly in the government's interest to get data faster, as Miriam just mentioned. And I think sophisticated prosecutors are more willing to work with you, even giving the unequal footing, so that they're able to get that data more quickly. It is an open and ongoing dialogue, and prosecutors who are willing to keep an open mind and be willing to work with creative solutions may really get data in a matter of weeks rather than a matter of months. And keep in mind also that at the end of the day, prosecutors do need to be mindful of appearing as, of what they do not wish to be appearing as unreasonable by asking for everything under the sun in a request. They may end up before a magistrate judge who is used to dealing with civil parties who agree in compromise and who may be uninclined to side with a prosecutor who has made such a broad request. And I would, as I discussed earlier, I would also note that the status of the defendant or of the respondent is very important to this analysis as well in terms of how much leeway you have in the negotiating process.
So how do you negotiate with a government agency, which is holding all the cards? I'm Justin. I'll keep going with you on this.
Well, I think it's a lot of what we talked about before. It's important to provide ongoing information about exactly where things stand. Not only I'm here, I'm representing the company. Here are the steps we've taken thus far. Here are the steps we've taken to preserve and lock down the data. Perhaps we've used a third party a vendor, which will give independent and which will give the government some peace of mind that the data really is locked down. Here is the type of data that we're finding. Here is how long. Here is the estimated cost. Here's the volume. All items that you can. Here are the we've looked at this. Here are the key custodians. Tell us what you want. And here are the individuals who are most likely to have that information so that we can get you what you want as quickly as possible.
Is it fair to bring proportionality themes into this? Like, we have 100 people who earn $100,000 a year working this number of hours on this type of a thing, and our profits last year were only this. And, I'm just throwing out examples, but, at a certain point in time, you can't spend all the money in the world to go after things without shutting the company down.
No, that's absolutely correct. And I think we are, this is one of the things I was actually going to highlight. It's actually interesting. Some of the, there's actually some courts that are now codifying in criminal matters that both the government and defense counsel actually sit down and discuss cost-sharing arrangements where appropriate. Now we're talking about post-indictment, but it is there is no criminal rule analog, again, as we've discussed, for the for not only for 26F but for Rule 26B2B, which is covers proportionality of discovery. But certainly, if a party from whom discovery is sought can show that the ESI is not reasonably accessible because of undue burden or cost, that's something that you want to raise with the prosecutors. And ultimately, you may make those arguments in a motion to quash, which often is not always the most successful approach, but it's certainly an argument that you can make.
And look, the government has limited resources in terms of being able to review massive quantities of documents and things like that. So, a lot of times, again, if you have a sophisticated prosecutor or regulator, you can have a reasonable discussion with them about how, a certain technique in terms of producing electronic documents is not only beneficial for my client and more cost effective for my client, but it's going to help you, Mr. Prosecutor, get to the heart of the case more quickly, you know, cut through a lot of the issues that aren't terribly important, and it's just going to be more efficient for everyone involved. Now, candidly, you know, there are some strategic considerations with whether you want to go down that road that you want to discuss with your client, but a lot of times there is a certain degree of alignment between the client and the government in terms of, you know, trying to do this in as efficient a way as possible.
Miriam, how does the ebb and the flow of an investigation impact this dialogue? I mean, suppose you just feel in your gut that things are not going well, like sometimes you do, or you have a production issue. I mean, what's your advice there?
Well, obviously, if you feel that things are not going well, you need to, I mean, I think everybody would agree, you need to have that open dialogue with the government and try and target where the unhappiness on their side lays. But before you even get there, hopefully you can avoid ever getting to that point. And I just wanted to talk for a minute about one way to avoid getting there. And this is probably the most obvious thing that I'm going to say, but it is the most important piece of advice that I can give, and that is to document every single step or conversation, every step you take or conversation that you have with investigators, be it just a civil investigation or a criminal investigation, and put it in a format that can be shared, so a non-privileged format that can be shared with the investigators. And that would include every discussion, every agreement on search terms, on privilege review steps, or any other action you're taking in your review that you've told the investigators about, and which items were left open for future resolution. Every data collection activity. I mean, this is probably an audit trail that you're making anyway, but putting it in a format which can be shared is extraordinarily useful. So your data collection activities, the custodians that were contacted, other sources of data that you looked at and determined responsive or non-responsive material were contained therein. Each search that was requested for the government, when they requested it, the results, how long it took to review, the production. When you run searches, if there's false hits, I mean, if you can record that, it really gives you a record of how you're spending your time, which can sometimes be shown to, you know, if there's a unhappiness on the sense of the government because you're not doing things fast enough, they're not getting what they want, and yet you have a record that you've been responsive to all that request, and some of the requests have simply led you down blind alleys, it's extremely helpful. When another item would be when resources were reallocated in response to investigators' requests, you may include in that spreadsheet when you have problems with technology. I mean, everybody who is in this area has had problems with technology, which has sucked up a lot of their time. And, you know, it's not a happy day when you have to call up the government and say, we're going to be late because, you know, whatever technology problem you had. But by recording it, you can also have a place where you can show that you tried to be responsive quickly to a new search term or a new request or a new custodian, but these were the problems. And, you know, the spreadsheet or tracking log or however you want to do that, which would also then, of course, include all of your productions and how they relate to either a particular item on a document request or subpoena or to an oral request, really then tracks the entire life cycle of the investigation in connection with the production of documents and of ESI, and gives you hopefully a really strong platform on which to have productive conversations with the government and avoid or temper unhappiness.
Okay, and suppose things are going well. Maybe not much good information or damning information is coming up. Can you get your litigation hold to be reduced in scope over time? You know, do you have any thoughts on that, Miriam?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Chris and Justin have to say on this. I mean, you know, the concern that everybody has, of course, is that once you've held something, if you have it, you have it. It's a nice safety net. Once it's gone, it's gone. And so, you know, if an investigation is complete, I think the only time that you can really feel secure releasing it is when an investigation is complete, that government agency has given the sign off, and I don't know how you ever know this, but hopefully at some point you do, nobody else is interested in the topic. Now, hopefully with the government, you might get their assistance with whatever agency you've been working with that no other agency is going to come in from a different angle. So there won't be a securities angle or you know, if it's product, there won't be FDA angle or something like that. But it's a very difficult question.
Yeah, I agree with Miriam on that. I mean, I've done it a couple of times, and it goes back to Miriam's point about documentation. I mean, that's something you have to be very careful to document that you've reached that agreement with the government. And it's usually, you know, at some point, you know, well along in an investigation, when you and the government can be quite confident that, you know, there might be a category of people that in your initial sweep, you know, a year ago, were asked to hold their documents in an abundance of caution. We now know enough about the case that we're convinced that those people really don't have the key information that needs to be preserved. The government is on board with that. It's well documented that they're on board with that, and then a decision is made to release the hold. But it's precarious. It needs to be well documented, and it's rare.
I would agree with that. That is a very, it's unique and uncommon, and it would be quite late in the process. And in fact, it seems to be often more common that because a client has done such a thorough job with preserving their data, that's in part of your negotiations, as we discussed earlier. That's where you're actually able to limit what you're producing, reducing costs and making the process more efficient and streamlined.
Let's talk about something that happens more often than not, Justin. I'm guessing databases are often requested by the government. Can impossible requests for data be turned around?
Well, your question is focused on databases. I'm not necessarily sure this is about the type of ESI. Certainly, databases are unique, but this is really again talking about the negotiation process that we've been talking about and about one's status in the investigation. Again, if you're a third party, you may have more leeway. You want to have very specific conversations with the government about what it is they want, about what the costs are associated, and what exactly it is that they'll be getting. Do they want this volume of data? Is that really what they want? Do they want a subset of that? If you were a subject or a target, and again, depending on the nature and scope of the investigation and how key or critical the specific ESI is to the government's case, whether it's a database or some other large set of data, you may be left simply with a negotiation or eventually a motion to quash. But again, as part of your negotiation process, it's very important to provide specifics of the burden and cost and of the impact of the company. And again, you want to have the conversations that we've been talking about to ensure that both sides are on the same page in terms of what data is being looked for and what is actually going to be provided.
Chris, how do you handle a government investigator who presumes you're already familiar with your documents when you aren't?
Well, this goes back to some of the issues we were discussing earlier. I mean, I try to, again, set the right tone in some of these initial discussions and then these ongoing discussions to explain, you know, the complexities here. If you're representing a big company, you know, this is a large company. This is how their IT systems work. It's not very straightforward. You know, these are the techniques, as Miriam was saying, being open with the government in terms of, you know, these are the resources that we're allocating to this. If we've brought in an outside vendor, which you often do when you're faced with a government subpoena, you know, this is the vendor we've brought in to help in these areas. And you're just straightforward and explaining to the government the realistic complexities that you're facing in trying to respond to the subpoena in the best way that you can. And, you know, these are situations where sometimes you hope that the prosecutor on the other side of the table does have some sophistication in these areas and doesn't think that, you know, it's a situation where, you know, ESI, you just sit at a computer, press a button, and, you know, all the relevant data just gets sucked onto a disk. And, you know, what are you talking about? And I have had some conversations with prosecutors that aren't that far from that, which can be somewhat surprising. But there are these various levels of sophistication out there. And sometimes you want somebody who has a little more background in this to make your life easier.
Miriam, I'm not sure if we answered this question before, but I remember you raised the issue. What do you do when you receive multiple document requests from multiple agencies, all requesting information on the same matter?
This issue can actually arise in a couple of different contexts. It often just arises when you're simply the recipient of a third party document request, and there are multiple agencies all working on the same investigation who've identified you as the holder of relevant information, and all of a sudden you get one, and then you get another, and then you get another. And what that sometimes indicates to me is that the agencies may not know that they each have independent investigations. In that case, I will often tell, you know, you have the prohibition for a grand jury subpoena, obviously, that you cannot release information about that, but I can at least alert the various agencies that I'm being contacted by them. And so it helps with that coordination. The best way that I have managed this in the past is to ask one of the agencies to take the lead and to coordinate amongst the agencies, especially when this is a high priority, you know, rush, and it's a lot of effort. You want to make sure that they're coordinating so that you can get them what they need as quickly as possible. If that's not really possible, you can also take simply the broadest subpoena or the broadest document request and produce that same volume of material to each agency that comes in, even if their request is somewhat narrower. And you would do this simply to save you or your client time and money.
Okay, now, Justin, this is a very brief answer because I did a one-hour podcast with Judge Grimm and Tom Allman on Rule 502, so you're limited to 50 words. How do you address a challenge by the government that your privilege review is too lengthy and time-consuming?
I'm not sure if I can do that in 50 words, but I'll be brief, I promise. You know, certainly the scope of your review or any privilege log is something that, as we've been talking about, should be addressed with the government early on in the process. With regard to 502, it does have some interesting impacts in the criminal sphere, especially 502D, where you have an agreement that's approved by court order. Getting that order in a civil realm is very straightforward, but in a criminal matter, one or both of the parties have to approach the court that's responsible for the grand jury, and a prosecutor may be reluctant to do so unless there's a clear benefit. The language of 502D actually says in the litigation and not in the proceeding, so it's unclear pre-indictment how that would work. But the government has counseled that they would consider going to a grand jury judge in order to get a 502D order in situations so that the production won't be slowed down. You're talking about getting data in weeks rather than months. There's really a clear benefit. I think 502 will likely be used more by what I've called innocent third parties, again, when we're talking about the status of the client. It's hard to see whether or not sort of a direct target of an investigation will be likely to get that much cooperation from the government in terms of 502D.
Now, I think you talked a little earlier about the concept of proportionality, Justin. So I think what I'm going to end up doing is just turning this question into a general question that I was going to ask to Chris about, are judges helpful in resolving power disputes between the party and the government investigation? And, you know, if Miriam and Justin, if you want to chime in with some proportionality concepts, because that might be a place where proportionality comes in. So, Chris, why don't you answer the question about power disparities, and then we can go back to proportionality if we'd like.
Yeah, and in terms of your question about judges' involvement, I mean, I view that as a bit of a last resort. You know, if you're dealing with a grand jury subpoena, there will be a presiding judge, you know, who could rule on certain issues. But I would be looking to go that route only if the government were being truly unreasonable. You know, I want to try to resolve any issues that come up really as best I can with the line prosecutors, or if necessary, to go up the supervisory chain, you know, within a U.S. attorney's office or something. Again, if you have you kind of have all your ducks in a row and you have good, valid arguments on why a particular request is unreasonable, you know, overly burdensome, overly costly, is not really going to elicit the information that goes to the core of the case. You know, I would just try to argue as hard as I could with the prosecutors and as I said, you know, go up the chain, up the supervisory chain if I needed to make those arguments before I turned to a judge. Justin, I don't know what your experience is on that.
No, I would agree with that. It is truly a matter of last resort, and that's something that you should consider carefully with your client before taking that step. And I would agree that it would only be after you've taken the steps that Chris has correctly set forth.
So Justin, at what point does it make sense to bring vendors into a government investigation matter?
I think it makes sense to bring them in early on, and certainly a vendor could assist with supporting a lot of the arguments that Chris just described in his prior answer. Vendor is very helpful to collect the ESI in a forensically sound manner, preserving the metadata, and it may give the government a degree of confidence that the preservation is being handled by an independent party. It's less disruptive and less intrusive options in terms of the client's business operations. Certainly when it involves less involvement from the client's IT employees and or the individual custodians. And I think most importantly, to the extent that any questions may arise in the future about the collections process, the vendor is, or preservation process, the vendor is in a far more favorable position to explain and defend its process to the government, including, if necessary, testifying in a proceeding.
I will say that I'm involved in e-discoveries a lot with the Association of Corporate Counsel, and the general sense, of course, although there's such a wide variety of sizes of companies involved in the organization, but the general sense is that corporations are trying to become self-sufficient, or if not completely self-sufficient, at least more self-sufficient in this area, so that they have the internal capacity. And this is, you know, to control costs, to control the process flow, to ensure justifiable productions, because ultimately they're going to be held responsible for them, and to really be able to capture a lot of this work themselves, bringing in a vendor to assist, let's say, you know, in the processing and review that stage, but in the identification and capture, it's becoming, I think, less. And you're seeing it less and less that a vendor is coming in to do the entire process, and that really is based on cost. It is, however, true that it's very hard to go into any type of government agency and argue that the cost is simply too enormous to undertake a particular task if you don't have the details around the cost. And in order to do that, it is obviously easier to assign costs when you have an outside vendor and you have specific, you know, invoices that you can point to, as opposed to costing out your own internal costs of personnel, of systems, and things like that. So more and more companies are looking at not just establishing the processes internally, but also being able to validate their own internal costs, so they have some data that they can go to the government with if they want to suggest an alternative. And you know, it's not very helpful to go to the government and simply say, I can't. You need to be able to go and say, how about this as an alternative, and let's see if that gets us closer to your goal, and it would reduce, you know, our cost and the expenditure of our resources.
One quick thing, just to support what Miriam just said, another thing that I'm seeing certainly in the past few years is, in terms of the use of outside vendors, is often they will be used to consult with a company's internal staff about a collection or preservation process, rather than handling the entire process themselves. Sort of a third option, I guess, so to speak.
It's a good hybrid. Chris, last question in this podcast deals with format. What format does the government agencies typically want ESI in? Is paper dying here too?
I think it's largely dying. There will still be some U.S. attorney's offices, some SEC offices, that I've dealt with from time to time, where there'll be a little more production in a paper format than you might expect. But increasingly, I'm seeing subpoenas both from Maine Justice and from the U.S. Attorney's offices that have very detailed 7, 10, 12-page sections on the form of production, describing in great detail the way they want the ESI to be produced. So that seems to be the way that this is all going. Now, candidly, I'll tell you that I've had some recent conversations with the line prosecutors where they'll say something very openly to me, such as, I don't really understand what these 7 to 10 pages of my subpoena mean exactly, but we'll have our tech guys get on the line with your tech guys before the first substantial production to kind of work it out. And this is another area, by the way, where there needs to be dialogue and negotiation with the government, because some of these forms of ESI production that they'll ask for could be problematic. For instance, I've seen a lot of subpoenas where they're asking for documents to be produced in native format, and native format can present a whole host of potential problems involving privilege and other things. And, you know, that's an area where you might want to push back on the government, explain why they don't really need documents, perhaps outside of things like Excel spreadsheets in native format, and you could reach a reasonable position on that. But I am seeing quite detailed subpoenas with respect to the expectations from an ESI perspective.
Okay. Well, that's the end of the questions that I have. I think this has been a very interesting show. I appreciate the three of you sharing your knowledge and experiences on ESI Bytes on government investigations. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you all later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically. If you sound out our website, it comes out as Easy Bytes, which is the way we like this information to be given to you, and is in the Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.